Good morning and welcome to the President's Day edition of Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Allison Kulo. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Roger.
Town is packed, and of course, the City Fathers came through by getting us a fair amount of new snow to make everybody happy. Should be an interesting President's Holiday Week here in Park City with lots of people and lots of snow. Who could ask for more?
I don't think we can.
Well, one thing we could ask for is an interesting show this morning, and we're going to start out this morning by talking to Dr. Nadia Zhekshambayeva, a resilience and reinvention expert who'll join us to talk about her new book, The Chief Reinvention Officer Handbook, How to Thrive in Chaos.
Tim Larson's going to join us. He's a managing partner at Squire & Company, and he's going to talk to us about how to understand COVID relief money and how it impacts our personal and business taxes this year.
And finally, we're going to end the hour talking with Stephanie Samuels. If you, like me, has been a bit curious about what's going on at the Park City Peaks with that construction, we're going to get to find out. She'll also speak about a new amenity they've added to the property. All this and more today. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In 2010, Blockbuster Video was a vibrant presence in communities around the country with some 4,000 stores, members in some 43 million U.S. households, and a net income of $268 million. This was also the year that Blockbuster rebuffed an offer from Netflix founder Reed Hastings to buy Netflix for $50 million. Today, Blockbuster is but a memory. Like other companies such as Kodak and Nokia, Blockbuster was unable to navigate the waters of a changing environment, notwithstanding its advantageous starting position.
But other companies have reinvented themselves multiple times in multiple ways to find continued success. So what differentiates these businesses? What are the lessons we can learn from them? And what are the tools we can use to emulate their successes in businesses large and small? We're lucky this morning to have with us Nadia Zhekshambayeva, the author of The Chief Reinvention Officer Handbook, How to Thrive in Chaos. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
I'm very happy to be with you today.
I spent some time with the book over the weekend, and it is not your typical business book. It's more fun to look at. It's organized in an interesting way. Tell us a little bit about your background, what caused you to write this book, and how do you say it's different than other books?
Well, I appreciate the feedback. Indeed, it's a very interactive book. It's filled with tools and workbooks. And the reason we decided to co-create this book with a community of about 3,000 people worldwide is we felt like we need to accelerate the learning that is unfortunately not happening. As you were just sharing so beautifully in the introduction, we see massive number of companies disappearing faster than ever before. So Blockbuster story is not an exception, it's a rule. So if you look at the original Fortune 500 list, already 88% of those companies disappeared. And if we look forward, research by Innosight suggests that about 50% of all Standard and Poor 500 will be disappearing by 2027. So this is a mass problem. And the reason we decided to create a book that is very pragmatic and field tested is because we are not yet improving our ability to handle disruption and change.
So in the intro, as you had concurred, we talked about Blockbuster, but in the book, you use Titanic as an example of companies who fail to recognize how things change suddenly. What lessons can we draw from the Titanic about why companies sink?
That's a beautiful question. So when I lived my life as a transitioning from academic to a business owner, one of my very first big projects was in mining industry. I was asked to help a publicly traded mining company, ENRC, London Stock Exchange, FTSE 30, to transition and reinvent itself as it was struggling and approaching bankruptcy. And we started looking at the statistics and the research on what kills companies and why some companies are able to reinvent and survive. And every lesson we learned was reminding us of something we've seen before, which is the story of Titanic, the infamous ship that unfortunately went to the bottom of the ocean on its first voyage. So what do we see in Titanic that we see in companies today? Number one, Titanic was in this assumption that we're too big to fail, we're too good to fail. And you can see it in things like this famous story of binoculars. So at the moment of collision, Titanic had binoculars on the ship, but the people responsible for noticing potential threats, the lookouts, did not have binoculars. They didn't have them because they were locked up, and the person who had the key left the ship, and nobody thought to break the cupboard and take the binoculars out. So this is a typical example of what we see in companies, is not having structured systemic approach to noticing trends, forecasting, and looking into the future broadly defined. We come from the past century, the 20th century, where the speed of change was very slow, and it was okay to look at the past to decide what to do in the future. For example, look at your past budget and adjust it for the future budget. Look at the past trends to see what will happen to your product. In today's speed of change, your past doesn't tell you much. You need to be able to learn how to see the future, to have those binoculars. And that's very similar to what's going on in the Titanic. And story after story, when you look and unpack the history of Titanic, you'll be surprised how much of that is appearing in some of the companies today, and also how to prevent it. So in the book, we offer a lot of exercises you can do with your team that will help you avoid the fate of Titanic, along with Blockbuster and many others.
We're obviously living in an environment that has been dramatically changed by an unexpected pandemic. But in the book, you suggest that these concepts of crisis, disruption, and chaos are not temporary, but something that we should expect to live with going forward. Why do you think that? And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this comes to research. When we started looking into why so many companies are disappearing in the 21st century, what in the heck is going on? What we discovered is that there is an underlying transformation going that is really fundamental, and it has to do with the speed of change. So the average life cycle of a business model and a company in the 20th century was about 75 years from the beginning of your company to its bankruptcy or its acquisition or merger, on average 75 years. That meant that I can graduate from college, enter your company, work in your company my whole life, retire from your company, and never see a single transformation in my life. And I simply wouldn't have skills to transform anything, to adapt, to reinvent, to pivot. Now, this year, we did our semiannual study, and the September 2020 research shows that the average life cycle of a business this year is about 6, not 75 years, but 6 years. That means we have to reinvent almost every few years. On average today, 60% of companies we surveyed reinvent themselves every 3 years or less, more often, which means that we need to learn how to pivot on a constant basis. And whether it will be a pandemic, a new competitor, a new regulation, a new customer expectation, it doesn't matter what will be the trigger, but you will be forced to reinvent. So why not prepare for it?
So as you said, this is something that needs to start taking place more frequently. And so can you give us the definition of what reinvention is, and how do we know things need to be reinvented?
Oh, this has been such a debate in our international community. As I said, we are a global community of practitioners, people inside businesses, academics, consultants, and we couldn't handle one definition. So in the book, we actually put together 5 definitions of reinvention. But simply put, reinvention is a practice of embracing change. It's a systematic approach. So we distinguish 2 forms of reinvention. Reinvention 1.0 is you have a one-time disruption. You create a kind of project around it. Let's say you're disrupted by new technology and you are reinventing your way around it. You're disrupted by new regulation and you're creating a project to adjust to that. It's a one-time event. You handle the transition and you move on to the business as usual. That's reinvention 1.0. Unfortunately, in today's volatile, uncertain environment, an idea that you can treat reinvention as a project, as a one-time event, is no longer safe and prudent. So reinvention 2.0 is a system. So in this case, it is a structured and deliberate effort to engage in healthy cycles of planned renewal that allow you to really assure that your company is future-proof.
One thing that I wanted to ask, I know with your background, you've worked with international companies. You know, in our area, we have a lot of small businesses. Do small businesses need to be looking at reinvention at the same frequency?
The amazing thing that the small businesses actually have to do a little bit more, because the speed of change in a small and medium enterprise is a little bit faster than the speed of change in those big, big, gigantic corporations. Your customers are asking for more things because they are comparing your local offering to the global multinational offering, but also your competitors and the startup community is constantly disrupting your comfort zone. So if you're in small and medium business, you have to reinvent a little bit faster. That's a little bit more often. That's what our studies show. But also, you're more equipped to do so. You don't have as much bureaucracy. You don't have as much of a slow movement and resistance. So you can take that and make that your competitive advantage, your nimbleness, your ability to stay agile and close to the ground and hear what is coming from your customers and from your business environment. You actually are more equipped to turn reinvention into your competitive advantage than some of those big corporations.
You know, it might be useful to help the audience with some specific examples of what you consider to be strategic reinvention. One of the ones that I thought was really interesting in the book was the Lush shampoo example. Can you describe that for us? Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. We studied a range of reinventions, going from very incremental, small, continuous improvement type of things, all the way to radical, disruptive reinvention at the level of a whole ecosystem. So a small reinvention would be improving the way you handle your meetings so you don't waste as much time. And radical reinvention, disruptive, would be things like Tesla changing the whole nature of not just cars, but also the way we charge, the way we sell cars, and so on. Lush shampoo is closer to more radical examples, and it's a story that always shocks me with its elegant approach to reinvention. So Lush shampoo was asking itself about the impact we have on environment, but also the financial limitations of a traditional shampoo. And they started with a very simple question: what do we sell when we sell shampoo? What is the actual value that we sell? And the answer, of course, was clean hair. And then they asked themselves which ingredients are necessary for clean hair and which ingredients are actually optional because they are often available on site or always available on site. And one of those ingredients that is always available at the time of the use of the product is water. We don't use shampoo without water. Water is always there. So Lush asked himself, why do we pump water, distill water, package water, ship water, because a typical liquid shampoo is about 80 to 90% water. Why do we do all of that waste when water is completely unnecessary for the value to be delivered, when water is available on site? So Lush decided to be one of the first companies in the world to patent a solid shampoo. A solid shampoo still has all the components of a traditional shampoo, so it's not a soap. It has oils in it, essential oils, and other type of nutrients that help your shampoo, your hair to stay healthy. But it avoids packaging. It avoids waste on transportation. It's good for the environment because CO2 emissions are down and many plastics is avoided and so on. And it's loved by the customer. And when I asked the company, how much money are you saving on this? They said, well, we will not tell you everything, but just on transportation costs alone, we're saving 15 times per wash, 15 times per wash. So just on transportation, 15 times. And they're like, oh, we're not ready to tell you how much we're saving on plastic and everything else. So you can be doing breakthroughs even without going super high-tech. This is not a high-tech story, but it's a beautiful story.
And are there any examples of sort of large companies that have made major pivots and sort of, you know, while they still have the same name today, they really aren't the same business anymore? I was thinking possibly of an AT&T or other companies like that.
Oh, there are plenty of companies. And the interesting thing about reinvention is that it's a balancing act between continuity and change. It's not about throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It's about preserving the best of what you have while finding a new and better use for that core competence or for that asset or for that essence that you are bringing to the market. And one of the story I love is the story of Philips. And if you remember Philips at the end of the century, so 1999, 2000, 2001, company was really all about appliances, specifically TVs. And if you were to ask the technical experienced people, what is the best image in terms of TV on the market? Many of them would say Philips is the best image. But that's not what the customer said. When you ask a customer, not a technical expert, but a customer, what's the best TV on the market? At that time, Sony was beating everyone hands down. So Philips asked themselves, what do we do best? And who might need it in a new and different way? And what do we do best? We're great at imaging technology. We know high-quality image. Who might need a high-quality image but doesn't need consumer marketing? Because clearly we're not super good at consumer marketing. And yes, there was one market, which is healthcare. So Philips makes most of its money right now producing machines that do MRIs and X-rays and so on that require exceptional high-quality image to find that cancer at the very early stage, but does not require any consumer marketing because nobody will advertise MRI machine on Netflix. So this is a perfect fit for the company, and that's a typical big company reinvention.
So you've talked about reinvention, and there's also innovation. And what are the differences, and I guess, is one better than the other?
This is one of the favorite questions people ask me. They keep saying, you know, innovation is the popular thing. That's the star child. Why in the heck are you going after the Cinderella reinvention? Well, for me and for our community, innovation is one form of reinvention. This more radical, disruptive thing is one off, but it is by far the least, I don't want to say the least favorite, but it's definitely not the only tool you have at your disposal. If you look at the research, and one of the best frameworks for understanding this is the law of diffusion of innovation. If you haven't Googled it, there's a great article on Wikipedia. Just go and put in your Google law of diffusion of innovation. You'll get everything you need. From that research, you know that about 2.5% of the world are innovators. 2.5 are innovators, people who produce new ideas. The rest of the world is not. The rest of the world does not like new ideas. We just looked at the studies on how comfortable people are with innovation. And even in a white-collar, college-educated environment, no more than 19% of people are open to innovation, like innovation, and like the risk associated with innovation. So we love the idea of innovation as managers, as business leaders, but most of our employees are very uncomfortable with it. When I put it simply for you, imagine if I give you an assignment. You need to invent an absolutely new breakthrough, radical way to transport goods of 10 pounds. Most people, if you do this in a real life, freeze when you ask this question. They get very uncomfortable. You have 5 minutes to invent a completely new breakthrough way to transport about 10 pounds of goods. But if you reframe that question as a reinvention question, how about you reinvent your backpack? Do you have one idea of how your backpack can be reinvented? Absolute majority offer at least one idea. So reinvention is an umbrella. Some of it can be true, disruptive, absolutely new, inventive idea. And most of it is building on the old and creating a new way or an improved way of the best of the world to apply to your business today. I hope that makes sense.
It does. And knowing that there are two different skill sets, my question is, when hiring, should companies be looking for more innovators?
I've never been asked this question. I myself believe that reinvention is a natural skill. So if you look at the baby, if the baby is healthy, my daughter will celebrate 17 this year, and I remember her learning that she has hands. So when the baby is healthy, you don't need to motivate them to reinvent, to try something new. You don't need to give a bonus to baby for them to start walking. Reinvention is built into us, right? This is natural for us. We even get emotional when we think about it. So we are born reinventors, but we're educated out of it. And unfortunately, we're educated not because of some horrible conspiracy, somebody trying to control us. No, it's because in the 20th century, where most of the schools were designed, we didn't need to reinvent. As I said, the average cycle of a company was 75 years. You could do the same thing all your life, never need to reinvent. So why would we waste your time giving you a skill that you don't need? So we are living with a leftover education system and a leftover recruitment system. And I would invite the companies to not only recruit people with stronger ability to change and adapt, with strong reinvention mindset, but also I would advise them developing a consistent investment in your talent's ability to reinvent. I truly believe, just like 100 years ago, reading, writing, and counting was the basic literacy skill. This century, reinvention is among the best literacy skills we can give to ourselves, our employees, our children, our community.
Again, one of the things I noted about the book was the way it is interactive. There's interesting graphics. There's interesting examples. But you conclude the book with three lessons to try to summarize for the reader. Can you do that for our audience before we leave?
Oh, absolutely. So for me, it all comes down to very, very basic things. Lesson number one, change is accelerating. Whether you like it or not, this century for sure, we will face greater amount and scale of change than ever before. And that means you have one of two options. You can fight the winds of change, be beat up by them, or you can make them your friend. And I suggest you turn them into your friend. Lesson number two. That is the opportunity when change happens your way, because it will happen more and more often. When change comes to your way, you will have an opportunity to use it to reinvent. And my invitation to you is to use change not as a punishment from God or from your competitor, not as a thing to hate, but as an opportunity to let go of things that no longer serve you and pick up the things that you want to add in your life. So choose change, choose reinvention rather than fight it. And lesson number three, good news. You know how to do it. All you need to do is to dust off some of your natural born reinvention skills, bring them to your company on a regular basis, create things like reinvention breakfast or reinvention pizzas once a month. You will be surprised how easily and naturally all of those skills will rush back to you and to your company.
We've been talking with Dr. Nadia Zhekshambayeva, the author of the Chief Reinvention Officer Handbook, How to Thrive in Chaos. Thank you for joining us this morning. Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We are going to be speaking with Tim Larson next. And really, what brought this upon our schedule is that the Internal Revenue System Service began accepting and processing 2020 tax returns just this last Friday on February 12th, more than 2 weeks later than last year. The delay was because the IRS needed more time to program its systems to reflect new tax rules.
Tim Larson is a managing partner at Squire & Company, and he joins us this morning to help us understand how COVID relief money can impact our taxes, both personally, for business, and other issues. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
So I'm happy to be with you today.
So, Tim, let's start with some big picture questions. A lot of people receive stimulus checks at least once or not twice during 2020. To what extent are those checks subject to federal and state taxes?
They're not subject to either taxes, and I'm not aware of any state that is taxing the stimulus money. They do, however, need to be reported as you prepare your return. And the reason is that there, if you did not receive the full amount that was available to you on either the first or second stimulus payments, those payments will be made whole through your federal income tax filing for 2021. Last spring, when the government was determining who was to get the stimulus payments and how much, they either relied on the 2019 return if it had been filed, or if it had not been filed, they went back to the 2018 return. And maybe you didn't file a return in any of those 2 years. And so if that's the case, if they used 18 and maybe you had a child during 19 or even 20, now when you file your 2020 tax return, the additional stimulus money that should have come to you will be on your federal income tax refund.
Will people be getting something like a W-2 or a 1099 or something to sort of remind them of what they actually received, or is that simply on the taxpayer to figure out?
Well, it's on the taxpayer to figure out. There will be no reporting by the federal government as to what each family or each individual received. However, there's a way on IRS.gov to look up your information and see, you can actually see the amounts that were received and when. And I believe it even shows the method that was used to disperse the money, either direct deposit or a check to the individual or to the family.
And so then we would be adding this to our income line on taxes?
No, it's not income. But all of this tax softwares that I've looked at have a methodology wherein you would enter the amounts received. It will look at you and your dependents, compare whether you got the right amount or not. Now, if you receive more, say you had a child that was a dependent in 19, so you got a stimulus, the first stimulus check and the second stimulus check, but in 2020, they're no longer a dependent. They may have gotten married during that period of time. There is no requirement to pay any of the money back. But the only option is if you did not receive the full amount that you would be entitled to based upon your dependents for 2020, that will be made up on your 2020 return.
Okay. That we talked about stimulus checks. Let's talk about unemployment compensation, because I know, obviously, there were a lot of people who collected different kinds of unemployment during 2020. Are those subject to taxation? And again, how would we know what to do there?
Yeah, those are subject to taxation. So unemployment has historically been subject to taxation, and you will receive a 1099 from the paying agency, typically your state unemployment agency. But yes, they are subject to taxation.
And if someone was furloughed, does that act any differently?
Well, it depends on being furloughed. If there's money paid in the process of being furloughed, like a bonus or a separation agreement of some kind, those payments would likely be subject to income tax.
Okay.
What other sort of, we want to go beyond COVID relief, but are there any other sort of COVID relief related legal issues that come up that would affect individuals' taxpaying that you can think of?
Well, one of the things that most people are probably not aware of, there were many credits that were scheduled to expire at the end of 2020. And the CARES Act, along with the Stimulus Act that passed on December 27th, extended many, many of those credits. And one example would be if you put new doors, new energy efficient doors or windows in your home, there's a potential $150 credit for that. That credit had been scheduled to expire on 12/31/2020, but now that's been extended, I believe, through 2025. I'm not exactly sure on that end date now, but there's probably 30 different credits that are expanded and extended for a period of time. Another one is the way you treat, if you pay mortgage insurance as a part of your payment on your mortgage each month, that too is extended, was scheduled to expire at the end of 2020. And now that's been extended, so that counts as an itemized deduction on tax returns through 2025.
That's good to know. Perhaps we kind of go towards businesses, because I know a lot of businesses received assistance through the different federal acts that had gone through. Let's start with PPP. Does PPP relief need to be reported, and again, will it be taxed? I know the state of Utah, the legislature, did have a discussion about this.
Yeah, so it was unclear. In the original CARES Act, there was nothing that really specified the way the tax treatment of the PPP loans or the expenses that were paid with those loans was to be handled. Under historical federal grant law, there's one of two scenarios. Either the grant is not taxable, But in all cases, historically, if the grant is not taxable, expenses paid with that grant are non-deductible. The other option would be you tax the grant, and then all expenses paid with the grant are deductible. So it ends up the same place either way you look at the treatment. So this is the first time in – okay, go ahead. You had a question?
Nope, keep going.
So this is the first time that we've had a situation where the federal government on the December 27th Stimulus Act made it very clear that they intended for the proceeds of the PPP loan to not be taxable. I guess I should specify that when forgiveness is achieved, forgiveness of debt is typically taxable. But in this case, the forgiveness is not taxable, and the expenses paid with that money that was forgiven are deductible. So you don't have to pay tax on the forgiveness of the debt, but you can also deduct now for federal purposes those expenses. So you get your cake and eat it too. So Utah they passed a law in August of 2020, wherein they stated that if the loans were forgiven and if the federal government was going to treat that under normal historical law, where you either the forgiveness is non-deductible but the expenses are not taxable, then Utah was going to follow that. But if they changed, which they did, then those deductions, those expenses paid with the PPP loan would no longer be deductible and would have to be added back to Utah taxable income before calculating Utah state tax. Currently, Utah is one of three states, but there are probably near 30 states that are still discussing the issue and haven't issued any guidance on it at this point.
You know, one of the interesting things is how often efforts to achieve social policy through tax law kind of, you know, don't exactly hit the precise target they were trying to go at. So as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, wow, there were some very large businesses that made a lot of money during this pandemic. We're still qualifying for PPP loans. And what you're saying now is the forgiveness of those PPP loans is not income, but the employee expenses that they were paying during that period is deductible. So it really is sort of a double windfall for those companies, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Again, it's the first time that I think ever in history where that particular tax treatment has been employed by the federal government.
Wow.
And here locally, there were different types of grants that were coming through the city and the government with additional funds for businesses. So there was a 2020 CARES Act. The Park City Municipal put that out. Would I guess they're not loans, they're grants. Would those grants then also be treated as income?
You know, I'm not exactly sure on the way those are to be treated. I've done a lot of reading the last year in trying to keep up on all of this. My understanding is that the intent of the Utah State Legislature was not to tax that money as it went to the business. I am not sure whether there's an add back for any expenses paid on with that money that was received. Now, they are treated as a grant from the beginning. There was no intent to have to qualify for any type of forgiveness. It was money that was a grant to the businesses. So whether they follow the grant law, which says, okay, here's a grant, so if you pay money with this grant, you're not able to deduct those expenses or not, I don't know. I haven't seen anything official or in writing that says anything about that.
I do want to go back real quick to PPP and forgiveness. So if someone received PPP, they've done all the work as far as meeting the guidelines for forgiveness, but they haven't filed the correct paperwork. That needs to be done before you file your taxes, correct?
No, that's not true. So the forgiveness is a totally separate issue. So for federal purposes, again, if you received a loan and incurred expenses in 2020, but you're just now starting to apply for forgiveness, so you don't have forgiveness, there's no need to wait to file your return before you apply for forgiveness. You'll just report those expenses, and then the only difference will be when you achieve forgiveness for federal purposes, that forgiveness is not taxable. But for Utah purposes, if you're a Utah business, when you receive forgiveness, that triggers the add back of the amount of the loan that was forgiven. So it would have to be added back again, only for the calculation of Utah income tax.
So, Tim, I'd like you to get out your crystal ball and change the subject a little bit, because obviously we have a new administration in power in Washington, and there have been sort of rumblings and noises about things in the tax law that the new administration would like to change. What would you expect to see happening this year on the legislative front in terms of significant changes to the tax law, and are they likely to be able to get them through?
No, I don't know whether they can get them through. It's difficult to get things through Congress, it seems, these days. If you look back at the Biden-Harris campaign website, they had a pretty robust explanation of the tax proposals that they would likely employ were they to be elected to the office of president and vice president. And they don't have much impact on individuals who whose total income is under $400,000. But there are a lot of provisions that if you're over that $400,000 annual earnings, there's a lot of provisions that will increase your taxes fairly quickly. First of all, the rate will jump immediately upon hitting $400,000 to 39.6, which was the top tax rate prior to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed by the Trump administration. And so that would be the immediate thing. But there's also the phase out of a bunch of other credits and other tax treatments that could quickly result in someone making that range of income, their rate would be more than 39.6. Likely it could be approaching 50 or 55%.
That's significant.
For most people, that's significant, yes.
So I think, you know, again, just what advice do you have for people as they begin filing their taxes this year?
Well, I have a biased opinion. I would say if you're not really familiar, I mean, really in-depth familiar with the tax law and followed all of the changes, there are so many changes in the last 3 to 4 years, then I would recommend that you seek out some professional assistance to help get your tax return prepared. First of all, the first step is to gather all of the documents. All of the documents that are needed are usually now mailed or emailed to the individual. And if you have a business that you run, then just make sure your accounting is good and square and all caught up and up to date so that you get that in. The IRS has said that the earlier you can file, the better. As you mentioned, just as we came on the air, there was time needed to do some programming changes. So electronic filing of tax returns was delayed. I anticipate that there will be other glitches along the way. And we've been told by the IRS that they will be very accommodating and lenient during this pandemic era with things that don't happen. And I'll give you just one example. There was an issue on a tax return that I prepared for 2019. The taxpayer received a notice in July. Late July, I wrote a letter explaining the situation and why the IRS was incorrect. Just last week, I received notice that they had just barely received that letter from late July. So that tells you how far behind the IRS is in processing any type of challenge or issue or other letter correspondence with the IRS. The other thing that we saw after the filing deadline in July, people who owed money submitted their payments via the mail, but the IRS didn't have enough people to process all of that, so they received a notice with a late filing or a late payment penalty because they had filed the return on time, but their check had not been processed yet. And so it had people really nervous and upset because they're just way, way behind, and they're still behind.
And I guess that's partly because they probably had issues with having personnel work remotely, like everybody else during the pandemic. But unfortunately for the rest of us, if we fail to have our businesses operate on time, we don't get to send people late notices.
That's right. Yeah, and what I would say, if you get something that is just, you're not getting any traction dealing with the IRS on your own or with your professional, one of the cards that I always hold in my back pocket is I've got two senators and a representative in the legislature in Washington that I can contact and ask for assistance. And their offices will provide assistance in at least getting a conference with the IRS and getting things resolved.
And for simple, I think for simple taxpayers, do you think that the sort of commercial software that's out there is adequate? And only if you...
Yeah, I think most of that software does a really good job. In fact, you can go to irs.gov and file for free. Mm-hmm. You can use software provided by the IRS. And if you're a W-2 wage earner and that's all you have and you're using a standard deduction, maybe you're married or you have one or two children, I think that will do just fine. The one thing, though, to keep in mind is there's a couple of provisions in the law for this year that most people could miss if they're using the standard deduction. And that is, in addition to the standard deduction, family, individuals, couples can claim an amount of charitable contributions above the line as an adjustment rather than as a deduction. For married filing joint returns, it's $300, and for single individuals, it's $150.
Good to know. Well, Tim, we appreciate your time with us today. We've been speaking with Tim Larson. He is with Squire & Company, and Mountain Money will be back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. As locals, we like to think we know about all the new and interesting things that happen in Park City. However, today I think our guest may have a surprise for you. Did you know that there's an outdoor ice skating rink at the Park City Peaks Hotel? Joining us this morning to discuss what they've got going on, all that and more, is Stephanie Samuels, General Manager at the Peaks Hotel. Thanks for joining us, Stephanie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you, too. So, an ice rink. Why don't you tell us about that?
An ice rink, yeah. With everything going on, really our focus was what can we do to get people outside of the lobby and congregating. And, you know, Versante on the Lawn was so wonderful this summer for us and for our hotel guests and even locals. We actually looked at that space first. And brainstorming efforts, the ice skating rink popped up and the need for that and just extra amenities to kind of separate us apart from our comp set hotels, and the ice skating rink was formed.
Okay, so where is it, Stephanie?
We are actually, if you look at the hotel, it's a horseshoe shape, and mm-hmm. in the middle we have a courtyard where we use in the summer for private events and weddings and functions, and we have a beautiful fire pit out there. Mm-hmm. So we took that lawn space, it's a little bit over 2,000 square feet of ice skating rink.
And so I got to ask you, how do you make an ice skating rink? I mean, obviously you've got a patio, a flat cement surface. You have to build up some walls and then add freezing equipment. Tell me about the mechanics of how you did this.
Yeah, so there's an easy rink setup. We actually purchased it from Canada. And then, you know, believe it or not, we've got a great local who's been assisting us, Vince, who's been working with us every night. We bought a pull-around Zamboni, too. It's been interesting, to say the least. I mean, it's not as easy as you think, and we've learned a lot. But, the fire department assisted in filling it up. But it's actually pretty easy to maintain once you get it filled up and the walls are there. And, you know, the little snow that we've had have been wonderful and pushed aside. We put some bistro lighting up. It's got quite a cute Hallmark feel to it. It's definitely not professional, but it's really special to us, and our guests are enjoying it.
So is it bring your own skates, or did you go and purchase some inventory to be able to outfit people?
We partner with Ski&C on site for ski rentals. So when we came up with the idea, they were 100% on board, and they were so fortunate to have them as partners, and they purchased all the ice skates for us. So it's actually just $5 rentals, but you can bring your own skates as well.
And then what is the charge for non-hotel guests to just skate?
Well, really what we've done is just partnered with Versante. If you're dining in with Versante, you can bring your skates and ice skate for free. And then if not, it's $5 rink fee, $5 ice skating rental. So it's $10.
And what hours is the rink available?
Yeah, And, you know, at first we were like, oh, 1 hour, but let's be honest, 20 minutes is pretty good on a 2,000 square foot ice skating rink. But, yeah.
No, but what hours is it available? What hours of the day?
Oh, I'm sorry. 4 p.m. to 8 p.m.
You know, one of the things about the Peaks in Versante is that of all the businesses in town, I think you guys have probably brought the most creativity and innovation, given our previous guest was someone about the concept of reinvention. And as we were talking to her, I was thinking about how well Versante and the Peaks have reinvented themselves. I mean, the outdoor space this summer was absolutely amazing. And now this. It makes me really wonder what you guys are going to come up with next.
Thanks. You know, really, it started, obviously, as everybody with COVID and what are we going to do? And the panic factor for us was our staff. You know, we've been so fortunate to have the staff that we have them year round, and just thinking, how do we keep everybody going? You know, and it really just came down to, we have wonderful investors and being an independent property saying, okay, how can we expand? And then once we were able to get our liquor license expansion on that, and you know, the city was wonderful in permits and allowing us to do that. Just, you know, we actually hit winter numbers plus an employee. So it's really, that was the driving force behind the creativity, was how can we keep this going? And again, the same thought process went through to wintertime, you know, and we've just been so lucky to still be as busy and to still have our hotel full and have our team on board.
What I loved about the summer and your outdoor dining area is I felt like it was a place where I could see locals, you know, a place where I could not necessarily get together with them, but I could wave across the lawn to the locals. Are you planning on bringing that back? And
we are.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so we've actually just put in our permits again with the city for the lawn, and everybody was so gracious with us. I mean, serving food about a football field length away was no easy feat, but everybody was so patient with their wait times and getting that going. We're in the process again of doing Versante on the lawn. Hopefully some COVID restrictions lift and we can get a little more creative with it and put an outside more of a feel for a bar, you know, more high tops and bar area. But we learned a lot too, and we're in the process of looking for a outside pizza oven to actually be able to cook pizza outside on the lawn. So that'll be a pretty neat experience. And then we've enclosed the Versante deck, knowing we had that outside seating option. And so the deck should be full, construction should fully be done here in about 3 weeks.
Looking at that, is it have permanent side walls, or is that something that you can take down during the summer and still have the outdoor feel out there?
No, those big glass windows are permanent. The side doors do open. The space is actually, when you're in there, it's a beautiful space. It's about, I'd say, about 1,000 square feet. What we're finding is a need is for that 30, 40 person intimate reception. I mean, we're getting flooded right now with summer business and requests already for that space. So no, I wish that it was a little bit more open sometimes, but you know, due to COVID, we thought just expanding our dining area to make people still feel comfortable dining inside. We're a little bit late on the construction factor, knowing that we're rolling it into March, but I think that it's going to fit a beautiful niche in our community for a private dining space that's not in a back room, that's not, you know, it's very open. We're actually calling it the sunroom right now.
So you anticipate that that will be not just part of the restaurant, but also available as a private or semi-private rental space?
Yes. Yep, that's the plan.
And you've mentioned a couple times a little bit about how your winter is going. Tell us a little bit about that, a little more about that. What kind of capacity are you seeing? And are you seeing, to the extent you have the information, are we seeing people driving rather than flying? Tell us about your tourist business.
Absolutely driving. Our parking lots are full, but we kind of anticipated that. Occupancy levels for us, our plan heading into this winter was, you know, get everything on books that we can. You know, we're not seeing the booking trends we have seen of year past where people are 6 months out planning their vacation. They're literally booking the week before they come. We can jump 25 to 40% occupancy within a two-week time span. So what did that look like? I mean, we really went aggressive after our cancellation policies and wanted to let people know that book, you know, book with confidence, book knowing that a week before your trip, if something happens, 24 hours before your trip, if something happens, we will work with you. That's really helped in building that confidence with our guests, knowing that, hey, you know what, I really am planning this, but my gosh, life is changing right now on a dime. Then we also lowered our rates, I mean, more than we've ever. I mean, some nights we're half of where we used to be, but that's really kept our occupancy up. For the month of February, I mean, even after January, our occupancy was exactly mirrored last year, essentially. I mean, the loss of Sundance is felt citywide in every business. But no, again, it boils down to our staff. We are fully staffed. Our occupancy in the hotel is full. We just came off of 4 days of a sold-out President's Day and Valentine's Day weekend. And just, again, with a lower nightly average.
And looking into March, I know, looking at the numbers that the chamber is able to pull, it does look strong for March as far as bookings go. Is it looking the same for you?
We are. Again, it's a lot left out there to chance with the booking trend we're seeing, but we were able to pull it off December, January. February is going to come through. We're hoping that that is just the trend we're seeing. And honestly, it's more of a summertime business trend, to be frank. Like, it's just carried through. And if everything stays up, we should have a really good March as well. And thankfully, we're getting snow now.
Absolutely. Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for both. We've been speaking with Stephanie Samuels. She is with the Park City Peaks Hotel. And you've been listening to Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back. Before we go, we certainly want to thank our sponsors who make this show possible. Jan's Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development with Pentry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
And just to run through our guests today, we had Dr. Nadia I can't do this right now.
Jackson Baeva.
She's the Chief Reinvention Officer Handbook author. Tim Larson with Squire & Company and Stephanie Samuels with Park City Peaks Hotel. You're listening to KPCW